The next case on our calendar, 04-2031, NRE CR. Mr. Young.
Thank you, Your Honor, Chief Justice Moyer, and members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Joseph Young. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney appearing on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Department of Children and Family Services. Let me at the outset state that insofar as this court has granted Mr. Pelsozzi's motion to designate his client as appellants, we are required to split time, and therefore I will take the first 6 minutes of the argument, defer to Mr. Pelsozzi for 6 minutes, and I would ask to reserve 3 minutes for my own rebuttal following Mr. Schultz.
The red light will light when your 6 minutes has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case comes to the court on a certified conflict involving issues of neglected children and proper disposition, therefore. The stated conflict, as submitted to this court and accepted, is whether, after finding that a child has been neglected in this case, a trial court is required to make a separate and distinct unsuitability determination prior to ordering that child be placed into the legal custody of a non-parent. And I think that the parameters of this case involve both statutory interpretation as well as case law application regarding case law present in various stages of this court's history.
I'd like to focus on what to me seems to be the issue. I don't have a lot of trouble with if you find the neglect and abuse on a parent, that may be inherently be a finding one suitability. What seems to distinguish this case from the other cases cited is you have that finding against one parent. You do not have that finding against another parent. And how can you take the child away from a second parent when that parent has never been found to be unsuitable? Does this court not have to go back and find that the second parent, the father, is also unsuitable or neglect and abuse against the father to take that child away? Why does that father not have the protection of being that father's child who has never been found unsuitable? And in this case, he was not found unsuitable.
I respectfully disagree with that characterization. I know that Mr. Schultz has proposed that position to this court. I think it's an incorrect assumption to say that this father was never found to be neglectful of this child. The statutes are very clear that the child is found to be neglected, not that the parents are found neglectful. A finding of neglect suggests that the child is without adequate care due to the faults of its parents.
Does it make any difference the fact that this father was not involved in this situation?
No, because the father is always involved in a situation. As I characterized in my reply brief, the father states that he was not involved in the direct neglect of this child, yet he admits that he knew of the mother's pregnancy, his involvement with her prior thereto, and he took no steps
to... But he was told by her he wasn't the father. And as soon as he found out, or somebody told him, he took steps, filed a paternity action, the mother dies, he files the paternity action, the child goes to the parents, and the child is with the grandparents because of the litigation taking 2 years, not because he didn't try to get the child right away.
Well, that's not true. In this case, the mother did not die. The mother is alive throughout this. He found out shortly after the child's birth that he was implicated in paternity. He did not file for paternity until some months later after the agency stepped in.
Yes, you could argue, quibble over, he found out. She's telling him he's not.
But the facts also establish the fact that he knew that she had a history of lying behavior, drug abuse, and that he was potentially the father.
Let's change the facts, because we have to make this law for all cases.
Absolutely.
Let's say it's a case where only the mother's found to be in neglect because the father has no knowledge. He's in Iraq.
That's a fundamental flaw.
He comes back. You've taken the child away. You found that the parents neglectful. You've taken the child away. The father comes back in Iraq, wants the child. It's with the grandparents. Is that a different fact scenario?
No, the fundamental flaw in that reasoning is that you are assuming that the court finds either parent neglectful. The court finds the child neglectful. This father, and a father in every case, is entitled to notice and opportunity to be heard. They have the full opportunity to appear before the court at adjudication and say, you know what, this mother neglected this child, but I am not neglectful, and I'm here and prepared to care for this child. And if they successfully argue that to the court can find that the child is not neglected, the court can dismiss the case, and would have no further jurisdiction over the dispositional orders.
Pursue that point about my understanding from the briefs that the father was advised of the hearing, the neglect hearing, and that he attended, but sat silent, apparently, or did not participate.
Absolutely. The record is very clear, and indeed, Mr. Schultz's brief points out that he chose to remain in the hallway during the neglect proceedings. He received the neglect adjudication at no time, either subsequently at the trial court or on appeal even, did he ever challenge the fact that that child was found to be neglected. The statute is very clear. Neglect implicates both parents, and I think the citation I make in my reply brief to the In re Teixeira S case is particularly illustrative of that fact. It speaks of an absent father, and it states that if he wasn't aware of the circumstances, could it be for any other reason that he's neglecting his duties to that child? Now, if you accept the factual argument that he was lied to, you have to look underneath that and say, was it a reasonable action on his part to rely solely on this lying, drug-abusing mother, which he has a complete history with, or to do further investigation on his own that he did not do? Having said that, I will...
Is there a due process issue then here, Mr. Young, or not?
I don't think there is a due process issue because the father was afforded every right that he was entitled to. He was represented by counsel as of September of 2001. Adjudication did not occur until July of 2002. He was present throughout the proceedings.
Say that. Could I have those dates one more time?
Yes. He was represented by Mr. Schultz at trial, who filed a notice of appearance in September of 2001.
Yes.
Not until July of the next year in 2002 did the adjudication come for hearing. He participated in these proceedings throughout and had ample opportunity to make argument that this child was not neglected and shouldn't be subject to the direction of the court.
Thank you.
So is there a waiver argument to be made here?
I think there is a waiver argument to the extent that this issue was not raised on appeal. Quite simply, the adjudication of neglect is not before this court and was not before the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. Without challenging that adjudication of neglect, you cannot say, I wasn't found to have neglected that child. That opportunity has come and gone.
We could find on the law for the father and on the facts for you, could we not, in this case?
Actually, I'm arguing for the law for us. The facts, I don't think really you can find differently as opposed to the law, because the ultimate...
I guess my point is I have a difficulty with your argument on the law, because it seems to me, as Justice Stratton has said, that we've said it over and over, that parents have this supreme right to their children, assuming that they're not neglectful and abusive. And here he has that right, it seems to me, but there's a real issue. I think there's a real issue of waiver. I mean, he had every opportunity to indicate that to the court that he was not neglectful. But how do we get around our cases in which we've said that parents, you first look at whether parents have a right to their children, and then if they do not, if both are found to be gone or neglectful, then you'd go to the next step. How do we get around those? That's a pretty strong principle in the law, isn't it?
The fundamental principle is a parent has a paramount right to the interests of the child in the first instance and everything else being equal. However, it does state that when there are issues of neglect, et cetera, or controverted custody, that parent's right gives way to the best interests of the child. That was a holding in Clark versus Bayer back in the 1800s. That was the holding of In re Cunningham in 1979. The focus of this issue...
The Cunningham, both parents were... That was an issue over custody and whether... Best interests of the children. Here we have a parent who the court below has said, or you, not the court below, but you're arguing this parent has, as a legal matter, has no right, or at least doesn't. There's not the standard to be applied in determining whether that parent who didn't have any contact with the child was neglectful or was abusive.
I guess the problem I have with that is a factual issue. And that factual issue is not before this court. There is no issue raised before this court regarding the neglect adjudication. The only issue before this court is whether, once you get beyond that point, which we've all gotten beyond because it was never challenged, does the court have to apply Hochstock to neglect cases? I think the law is very clear that Hochstock does not apply. It's limited to custody cases. What is often confused in this matter is neglect cases are not child custody cases. They're child protection cases. They very well might find a child neglected and leave the child in the home with protective supervision. There are a wide range of dispositional alternatives, many of which involve custody. That does not make this a child custody case. Even the In re Perales decision recognized that. It established an unfitness test because there was no best interest test in the A2 portion of the statute, but it also stated in its footnote 9 that the reason they're instituting the unfitness standard in child custody cases is to closely approximate the protections that are already procedurally available in neglect cases pursuant to 353. So Perales itself, this court, recognized that neglect cases already have built-in procedural protections. It's these other private cases that we need to step in and declare an unfitness test.
So, counsel, basically what you're saying is that A universal finding of neglect here by the court references the situation the child finds him or herself in and is not an individualized process for each parent or guardian, depending on the circumstances of the child.
Absolutely. I think that's an accurate determination of the state's position as well as the state of the law.
And then when that finding of neglect is made, the next burden upon the court is to determine the best interest of the child, which would determine placement or custody of that child.
Absolutely. And I think that all of the case law from this court supports that. Mr. Schultz asked that you revisit Cunningham in light of Hochstock, which is essentially in light of Perales, yet fails to note that Cunningham was issued 2 years after Perales and is not in conflict with the Perales decision. There are two different types of cases. Mm-hmm. There's the only reference that they share is that they share a common overhead statute regarding jurisdictional issues. It doesn't require that they be treated the same way because, quite frankly, they're two quite different types of cases. I know I'm running well into my my co-counsel's time, and I would ask that you hear him at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Young.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Mr. Pesozzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices. Dale Pelsozzi, I represent Clifford and Stephanie Rust, the maternal aunt and uncle who actually do have custody of this now 5-year-old child, or will be 5 years old on October 4th. I think this is a question of waiver, and it's a question of acquiescence in the process. I recall, and I didn't raise it in my brief because it was not on the record anyplace, that during these proceedings, Mr. Crowder was actually in the courtroom, and he was represented by competent counsel at all stages of the proceedings.
Does that appear in the record?
Now, in July,
does that appear in the record?
No, it did not, Your Honor. But Mr. Schultz was in the courtroom. In July, when the dispositional hearing was made, I recall very clearly there was no objection. There was a stipulation that this was a neglected child. She was actually born drug dependent because of Susan.
But the father was not named in the neglect action. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. But
and he was told that he did not need to participate, and he was told to stay in the hallway by somebody other than his own choice. Is that not correct?
That is not correct, Your Honor.
So I believe you dispute that fact that appears in the brief, but you would dispute that?
Yes.
Is there any way to verify that in the record?
I can't cite to the specific part in the record, but Mr. Schultz was in the room at the time representing his interest.
But you do not dispute that he was not named in the action?
I do not dispute that fact, Your Honor.
Okay. Does that have any bearing?
No, it does not. Because I think at that point in July, when the dispositional hearing or when the adjudicatory hearing was conducted, following that, there was plenty of remedies within the 90 days required to have the dispositional hearing. He could have filed a motion challenging the finding and saying, you may have found Susan Rust as being neglectful. I am not a neglectful parent. I challenge this, and I want an adjudicatory hearing on my issues. Yet he proceeded to the hearing, to the dispositional hearing, and presented his entire case that in the best interest of the child should either be given to myself or to my mother. He argued in the alternative himself, give the child to my mother, I'll be happy with that. And at that point, he did not raise it. He acquiesced and he sat on whatever rights he might have had. The court followed the procedure under Juvenile Rule 29 and 34, bifurcated the hearing, giving everybody an opportunity to be heard. He did not raise it until after the dispositional hearing when the result wasn't what he wanted. And I would say implicit in the finding of best interest of the child, when you read that record, he had neglected his first two children. They were awarded to his mother. He had supervised visitation and consistently violated that order.
But the magistrate still found he would have been a suitable parent, did he not?
No, he found that he didn't find unsuitability. He found that he had an appropriate house. He didn't find.
Didn't the magistrate use the words that he would be a suitable parent? They actually used the words in the opinion.
That I don't recall if he did, Your Honor, to be quite honest with you.
I believe it's in there. I'll double check.
But in any event, in the best.
Could he not have expected that at the custody hearing, if he were found to be suitable, he would have a primary right to have the child?
No, Your Honor, and that wasn't the focus.
Because you could always argue that, you know, somebody can do something better for a child. They have more money, they have more resources, they have more assets, they're retired, so they can devote full time. I mean, best interest, you can often lose that argument when you start weighing those sort of factors. I just keep getting back to the fact that this person was not found unsuitable, and yet you are stripping him of all his father's rights.
he acquiesced and gave up his father's rights by not challenging the finding.
If we accept your version of the facts.
Exactly, Your Honor. And there's ample evidence in the record that he was an unsuitable parent. I would disagree with finding that he was suitable, given the totality and the history with his other two children. See, my time is up. I'd like to at least leave some time for rebuttal for my co-counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pezzozzi. Mr. Schultz.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the Supreme Court. I'm James Schultz. I represent Jesse Crowder, the father of the child in this matter. Your Honors, first I'd start with the proposition that the United States Supreme Court has defined under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution that the liberty interest of parents in the care and custody and control of their children is perhaps the oldest of the fundamental liberty interests recognized by the court. Justice O'Connor wrote, and she cited in the opinion in Troxel, Wisconsin versus Yoder, the primary role of the parents in the upbringing of their children is now established beyond debate as an enduring American tradition. I would take issue with the fact that Mr. Crowder voluntarily did not fight the allegations of neglect. Mr. Crowder, and I was his trial counsel, we were instructed to stay out. We weren't invited into the hearing for mother's admission as to neglect. We had no opportunity to do that. The only time we were able to participate was in the dispositional hearing of the case.
Counsel, did your client receive notice of the adjudicatory hearing?
Yes, he did.
Based upon his acknowledgement of paternity?
Yes, he did.
And then you were retained by your counsel?
That's correct.
Or by your client, excuse me. And the hearing, the adjudicatory hearing took place?
That's correct.
And you were instructed to not be present in the room?
We were instructed to wait outside in the hallway. I would represent that to the court as an officer of the court.
Is this all in the record?
I don't know if that appears on the record, Your Honor. It was a couple-day hearing, probably 800 pages of transcripts. I simply cannot recall if that was actually on the record or not, Your Honor. I certainly can represent that to be true as an officer of the court, however.
Who instructed you not to be in
the magistrate, room? Magistrate Major, directly.
And was your client ever called then to testify?
Not in the adjudicatory hearing. Only the dispositional hearing were we participating. I would point out to the court that it seems that in Children's Services brief, they argue against the paramount right of parents to have custody of their children. They talk about Inri Cunningham. Well, let's think about what went on in Inri Cunningham. Inri Cunningham cited Inri DR, which cited Inri Johnson from the 4th District. They find in there that adjudication of dependency, which would apply to abuse or neglect, implies that the parents are unsuitable. Should we take away a parent's fundamental right to raise his or her child by an implication? Look at the facts of the case that we have before us here. What happened here? My client was lied to about the mother being pregnant. Then he finds out that she gave birth. He tries to inquire as to whether he may or may not be the father. He can't reach her. Then he finds out through his other two children that he may be the father. So he takes action. He gets in the case. He hires me. He asks for genetic testing. He gets genetic testing done. After he gets genetic testing done, he gets on the case plan. He's allowed visitation. He exercises the visitation. He gets all kinds of services that are requested by the aunt and uncle and the mother. They accuse him of being a drug person, being drug dependent. So he takes a drug screen with the agency. He also submits 3 drug screens from his employer, who he was employed with at the time of trial for 6.5 years, where drug testing is a condition of his employment. Okay. A whole 6 days after the results of the agency's drug screen are there, here come the aunt and uncle and the mother making new accusations against my client, saying he's domestically violent, even though they have no proof whatsoever at trial. No charges, no convictions, no nothing. So what does he do? He takes a domestic violence class. He does everything the agency asks him. At the trial, The social worker from Children's Services testified. Father requested genetic testing. Father immediately expressed an interest in seeing the child. Father expressed an interest in custody, quote, on a number of occasions. Paternity is established. The testimony at trial by the social worker is that Father completed the case plan. He did everything that the agency asked of him. He did a number of urine screens, which were all negatives. He did domestic violence classes, even though he was never even had charges against him for domestic violence. His home was appropriate. There were no safety issues. He has adequate facilities for the child. The social worker testified that the father loves the child. The social worker testified that Father pays child support for his other children, that he did his parenting classes, that he did everything she asked. Then his mother testified in court that he's appropriate around all the children.
Your time is running, we have a legal issue here that we need to decide. The facts we can find from the record, but the legal issue is whether, I think Justice O'Connor stated it very well, their one view of the law is that the determination of neglect of the child doesn't go to the persons. It looks at the child. Has this child been neglected? And that you don't have to have both parents in the courtroom on the record to determine that, that if the status of the child is neglected, that someone in your client's position cannot complain, well, I wasn't heard, because that doesn't matter. Speak to that issue.
My point to the court is that even the father may not have participated, he was told not to participate. He doesn't participate. Mother neglected the child. Well, he wasn't even the father.
You're back to the facts again. Why should this court hold?
Because it takes away my client's fundamental right, the highest right that the Constitution
protects. Isn't your client incumbent upon your client to interject himself into the process if that is if he's attempting to exercise his parental prerogatives here?
He did. He participated at all stages of the proceeding.
No, we're not.
He was told to wait out in the hallway.
And what you would have us say is that the neglect determination was only with regards to the mother.
That's correct. That's exactly what I would have
but
you say.
But that's not how a neglect process is, how the law reads as it applies to the juvenile court. And the process. It's this child is neglected by those who are responsible for the well-being of that child. And primarily, you look at mom and dad. And there is opportunity at those adjudicatory hearings to bring forth that evidence. And that is the area in which you do it. And once that finding is made of neglect, it's neglect as to the mother, neglect as to the father. If the child was a previous court order in the custody of a relative, neglect as to that relative. And then the dispositional hearing takes place. That's the structure that the legislature has put into place here. Now, there's a room for objection, of course, to the adjudicatory, and that was not exercised here. Another indication of a waiver of the first prong or the first portion of the process. And why is that not?
Should that eliminate his constitutional rights because he didn't participate?
Because he didn't exercise what was necessary, what their law requires in order to preserve those rights.
How could he have exercised anything? He wasn't involved with the mother at the time the neglectful acts occurred. He would have no testimony to offer.
You're missing the point here. Let's start from the focus of when he received notice of a court proceeding.
He maintained all the way through. He never did anything neglectful to the child. He was told to stay outside. Besides, look at the case of Hochstock and compare it to what's going on here. In Hochstock, it's just like an agency case, only the agency wasn't involved. In Hochstock, the grandparents, mother voluntarily signs over custody to the grandparents. Okay? She has to, in writing, she agrees to do certain things. For 6 months, she gives temporary custody to the grandparents, the same thing that we do in a children's services case. Then, mother had obligations similar to a case plan. She has to do counseling. She has to encourage her live-in boyfriend to do counseling. She has to pay child support. She has to take parenting classes. She has to do all the things that we would normally do in a children's services case. And in that case, this court found that the parent was entitled to an unsuitability determination. How is that different than a children's services case as a practical matter? Besides the fact that this is my client's fundamental right, that if the state imposes on it, we're supposed to use a strict scrutiny analysis of that. Now, what justification is there under a strict scrutiny analysis to treat the facts in Hochstock different from the facts in this case before the court today? I submit that there isn't any. You look at what Henry Cunningham says. It says that the parent's fundamental rights should be taken away by an implication. Frankly, I think the neglect statute that should make a specific finding as to who is neglectful of a child. What is the point of the UCCJA affidavit that says, have you ever been found to be the perpetrator of a neglectful act on a child? Nobody ever answers that. Yes, why? Because the court never makes that determination. Why do we have that in the UCCJA affidavit at all, the way we're dealing with neglect cases before the court as it presently stands? Frankly, the court should make a determination as to who's the neglectful parent. And the fact that my client was told not to go into that hearing should not eliminate his constitutional right to custody of his child.
Counsel, if I understand the Court of Appeals holding, if we affirm, your client does not necessarily get custody of this child.
That is correct, Your Honor. It would simply go back for a trial on the issue of suitability.
Right. And had he participated, had he been in the room, in terms of looking at all the other potential cases. Let's say you have the fact pattern here. The mother had legal custody, or at the time that this unfolded in juvenile court, right?
Yes.
And he had visitation rights.
No, he did not have visitation.
He did not have any.
He had not established paternity. He wasn't even aware that he was the father of the child at the time the neglectful acts occurred.
All right. So at the time of the hearing, he still had not established
paternity. He had established paternity by the time of the adjudication and the disposition. Yes, he had.
Yeah, but he had no visitation established?
He did have some visitation at the time the hearing took place, at the adjudicatory hearing. He did have some visitation at that time.
Now, which adjudicatory hearing are you talking about? The neglect or
neglect.
The
neglect, yes, not the dispositional hearing right. That occurred later. There was 2 days
of
that.
What I want to know is, so if a non-custodial parent appears, and if there is provable neglect by the custodial parent, what is to be the finding of the, and I guess the prosecutor will have an opportunity, what's to be the finding of the magistrate?
Finding of the magistrate should be the child is found neglected, and the child was neglected by the mother.
Well, but the statute, as the prosecutor says, the question is this a neglected child? So,
sure, I understand, Your Honor.
So the magistrate and the prosecutor, right, that finds this is a neglected child, period. Mm-hmm. And how does that change the legal position?
In my opinion, it shouldn't change the legal position. My client should be entitled to.
Yeah.
My client should be entitled to an unsuitability determination at disposition. And in fact, as the justice pointed out, the magistrate specifically found my client to be suitable. Said he had an adequate home, he had adequate resources for the child.
Well, no, you argue
visitation,
that
did everything
that
he was supposed to do.
You argue that there was no determination of unsuitability.
That's correct. There wasn't. In fact, the magistrate specifically found him suitable.
Where do we find there was a determination of suitability?
I don't think we'll find that.
I don't have the decision in front of me, but I believe
magistrate's opinion.
Magistrate's decision said that he was suitable.
Well, it said he'd done that everything
should be,
that was...
Once the magistrate decides that he's suitable, how do we eliminate his fundamental right to have his child at that point, regardless of who neglected the child originally? How do we eliminate that fundamental right, the number one right protected by the United States Constitution and by Section 16, Article 1 of the Ohio Constitution? How do we eliminate that?
What would the magistrate base that... If he did, and I don't think that
he based it on the social worker's testimony, my client's testimony, my client's mother's testimony.
I'm talking about at the adjudication hearing. Your client did not participate.
He did not participate in adjudication, but in disposition, there was a two-day trial at which time my client was thoroughly examined and cross-examined with respect to the issues about his ability to parent a child. And the social worker testified. She investigated his home. She had him on the case plan. She was present at visits. She did what she was supposed to do to see whether or not my client was suitable. And there's no question that she felt my client was suitable. If you look at all her testimony that I've already recited and won't repeat, it's crystal clear that the social worker thought my client was suitable.
Well, but we don't even need to be talking about that here, do we?
I think we are. Your Honor, with all due respect, I think we are.
The question is whether or not he's entitled to a determination
of unsuitability.
Unsuitability.
Correct. Correct.
And it hasn't gotten to that.
That's the point, is that it's supposed to get to that before you take custody away from him, eliminate his paramount right to custody. You first have to find him unsuitable. That's why the magistrate's decision was wrong, was because the magistrate found the guy suitable, and then it gave custody to a non-parent anyhow. That's against what Hochstock says. Then we go back to, look at the difference between Hochstock and this case as a practical matter. There isn't any. The only difference is that Children's Services was involved. In Hochstock, what's the difference between A1 and A2? Just because Children's Services was involved. The fact of the matter, in Hochstock, the grandparents took the place of Children's Services. They did the same thing Children's Services would have done. They took temporary custody for 6 months. They essentially gave her a case plan. And this court found in that case that she was entitled to an unsuitability determination. Why should my client be treated different? And think about the public policy. Don't we want to encourage fathers to take care of their children? We have so much trouble with child support issues, fathers not being involved with their children, with visitation, with not paying their child support. This decision would seem to go against the public policy of trying to encourage fathers to take care of their kids and do the right thing.
Counsel, don't get overly wound up about the merits of your client taking care of children, because his record is checkered in that regard.
We have
important legal issues here, too, as the Chief has been trying to get you to focus on.
I think the legal issue is Hochstock is no different than this right here. A1 and A2 custody determinations, and it is a custody determination. I disagree with the prosecutor who says that this type of situation is not a custody determination. It is. And it's no different than Hochstock. And my client should be afforded the same rights as any other person. And we should encourage fathers to want to step in, to want to do what's right, to take custody of their child, their child, to encourage families.
Use your time, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you, Justice.
Thank you. Young, you saved 4 seconds. Take 30 seconds.
Counsel, I apologize. The magistrate's testimony does not use the word suitability. The phrase is, testimony also shows father has a stable and appropriate home and a good job. He has complied with all the expectations of Children and Family Services regarding Carly.
That's correct, but that does not establish suitability to provide
counsel. Counsel, here's the legal problem we're arguing over. Let's take a different case with the same facts. The magistrate doesn't tell the father and the lawyer stay out. Is in there, but undeniably the mother has neglected the child. Don't you still have a finding of neglect?
You always have a finding of neglect.
That the child is a neglected child at that point.
Yes, the problem, I think, is we're looking at this from the wrong angle. You have to understand that Perales established unfitness only because private custody cases did not rise to the level of neglect cases. Footnote 9 clearly states that. The purpose of the unfitness test is so that private citizens would have the same protections as do parents in neglect cases. Therefore, the jurisdictional basis is the reason for the difference between neglect cases and custody cases.
Let me take that, Justice Pfeiffer's question, a step further. You have the neglect case, the adjudication on neglect. The father is in there. The father has not had custody, finds out there's neglect, wants to get custody, argues that he will take care of the child, and proves he can.
Mm-hmm.
Do they find no neglect? Or do they find neglect because the mother has neglected and then do something with the father?
That's up to the trial court on a fact-finding basis. If they can determine that this child is not without adequate care because there is an appropriate parent despite the actions of the other, they can dismiss the case or refuse to adjudicate.
Then what do we do with this case? Were you trial counsel?
No, I was not. But I would again state to the court that the issue of neglect is not even before this court.
But if the defendant is not given or the father's not given an opportunity to participate in that hearing, don't we have a due process problem?
Well, I don't think, first of all, that the record reflects that. Mr. Schultz made statements, Mr. Pelsozzi stated.
You deny his representation to the court that he was told to stay in the hallway?
I can't comment either way because I wasn't present. I also heard Mr. Pelsozzi.
So you have no evidence to refute it either?
No, but Mr. Pelsozzi is an officer of the court and he states the opposite, and I do not wish to choose sides between two members of the court. I rest on the record, and the record specifically shows that Mr. Crowder had every opportunity to participate before, during, and after. Nothing prevented him from filing objections or asking that that neglected adjudication
be overturned. So in your opinion, the suitability of the other parent, who's not been involved up to the point of that hearing because of whatever circumstances, is immaterial if one parent has neglected?
No, I think that suitability itself as an idea and concept is not involved in neglect cases directly to the extent that they're required to make that finding. That's very clear from this court's own precedent. I think once the court adjudicates neglect, then it is a best interest test, and certainly Mr. Crowder may prevail at disposition. That's a manifest weight argument, not an issue of rewriting the law. I think the problem here is neglect cases are covered by a comprehensive set of provisions in the statute that just don't cover private custody cases. Once you get an A2 jurisdictional establishment, the only decision before the court is what is the custody of this child? Neglect cases. You have to go through a comprehensive set of steps to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the child is neglected, and if you fail in that regard, the court has no jurisdiction to entertain any of the dispositional alternatives. That is a very strong protection of due process rights that is not present in A2 cases. That alone distinguishes A1 from A2.
There apparently wasn't even a hearing on the neglect issue, was there? Because the mother admitted that that neglected.
There was a hearing of sorts. It was based on admissions. Father, for reasons I will not speculate, did not debate or challenge that. But bottom line is, because of that, is not before the court. The only certified issue is whether Hock and Perales and its progeny apply to abuse neglect. Clearly, they do not.
Let me hear your strongest argument again, why we should not apply the Hockstock.
We should not apply Hockstock, which is actually Perales and its progeny, because it relies solely on Hockstock. Perales specifically limits its holding to cases of A2 jurisdiction involving private custody. It, in its own opinion, distinguishes between A2 and A1. It states that courts are not bound under A2 by the provisions of A1 and the neglect statutes. It limits it, and again, Perales states that the reason it created this unfitness test is so that the A2 cases would more closely approximate the A1 cases. That's found at footnote 9, and it clearly states that the reason for this unsuitability is so that these parents in private cases would have the protections that are already present in neglect cases. There's no reason to apply Hockstock to the neglect cases where it has not been established that that's appropriate.
There is this statement from Hockstock, and it's so long, I'll read it quickly. The important principle that harmonizes Perales and Macedo is that regardless of which court had jurisdiction, the juvenile or the domestic relations division, this court recognized the overriding importance of a trial court making a parental unsuitability determination on the record before awarding custody away from a natural parent to a non-parent. These two cases demonstrate the significance of fundamental rights and natural parents.
Yeah, that's a very good distinction when you focus on the proper holding of Hackstock. They're talking about custody determinations between a parent and a non-parent. That's a private custody action which is limited by the...
Well, but let's take away the private. Why shouldn't the rule be the same, regardless of whether it's private custody or we have a child who ultimately we want to be raised and so forth, and the issue is who's going to do that ultimately? And why shouldn't there be why shouldn't we apply at least the sense of Hackstock to say that the trial court has to determine whether both parents are unsuitable?
I think we do that, and I think that's a matter specifically for the legislature. But Perales itself commented that regardless of which test you use, the result is often the same, and the focus is pretty much the same. The bottom line is Hackstock, as I said before, involves one decision by the court, who gets custody. A1 cases do not do that. You have to have a neglect finding, which involves state intervention, which presumes that there is a fitness question. The cases that are cited by the Ohio Supreme Court, as well as the Supreme Court of the United States, state that inherent in a finding of neglect is an implication of unsuitability, and that's not just based on an implication that comes out of nowhere. That clearly is stated in all the law out of this district, both in the A2 cases and the A1 cases. Troxell itself, which Mr. Schultz refers to, Troxell versus Granville, dealt with visitation.
But isn't fundamental to your argument then the assumption that the due process neglect hearing is a substitution for a determination of unsuitability?
No, and again, as I said, that's a reverse view of it, because unsuitability only arose to bring the private cases up to the level of the neglect cases, not vice versa. It's not a matter of neglect statutes approximating an unsuitability determination. It's exactly the contrary. Unsuitability exists because it used neglect cases as a model. And I think that's a fundamental point that needs to be understood in these cases. The Perales decision was issued in 77. In 79, this court considered the neglect situation and unsuitability in Cunningham and specifically stated that unsuitability is not explicitly required in neglect cases. It's a settled issue in this regard, yet it's deserving of this court's attention because of the confusion created by Hackstock and the 8th District's interpretation thereof.
Thank you, Mr.
Is it helped when you focus on the child in Section 1 and the parents in Section 2? The unsuitability really relates to the parents themselves, whereas the issue of neglect really relates to the child.
I think that's an excellent observation, and I think it underscores the decision or the point that in these private custody battles, there is no focus on the child as being neglected. It strictly is a decision as who would best provide for these child, and parents in that situation do have a fundamental right to oppose custody of others. All these cases that deal with A2 basically arose because parents were trying to get their children back from informal arrangements that they made in the past. That is not the case when the state becomes involved and has to remove a child from a dangerous situation.
Counsel, this is not a permanent termination of parental rights based on a finding of neglect.
That's correct.
In this particular case.
Yes.
This is a temporary placement, for want of a better term. The finding of neglect, the Children's Services has not moved for a termination of parental rights here.
Absolutely not, and they will not, because they determine legal custody to be a final order that preserves the parental rights. In fact, this court, in the case of Reynolds versus Ross County Children's Services Agency, specifically stated that the requirements of due process as set forth in Santosky versus Kramer were not applicable to temporary custody proceedings, because Santosky's holding was that before you terminate parental rights, you have to prove by clear and convincing evidence the allegations. And since this is not a termination case, and the fact that Ohio already requires clear and convincing evidence, mm-hmm. Santosky does not further illuminate the discussion. And the fact that it states that parents have a fundamental right issue.
So can the father come in and seek custody back?
He can.
And what is the standard? Is it best interest now, or is it unsuitability?
Well, it is a best interest standard. And I think
well,
that would be...
he's lost permanent custody if he can't meet best interest.
Permanent custody means he has no rights at all in this child forevermore.
In essence, it's the same thing. If you're going to look at best interest,
well, it's clearly
not
because permanent custody and legal custody are two separately defined legal distinction in the statute itself. I don't think you can call it a permanent custody situation when the father's rights are intact, because that's contrary to the very definition of permanent custody.
Counsel, the father still has the ability to have a visitation schedule, spend time with the child. That has not been terminated either.
Absolutely not.
Part of a dispositional, maybe a second phase of a dispositional, depending on who the award of this child goes to.
Correct. And he always has the opportunity to file for a review of that custody order subject to the court's determination. And that's true in the A2 cases as well as A1. They specifically state a father doesn't get a second unsuitability test at that point. It's always best interest once that is done. So you compare that, you focus on the correct distinction. Neglect is involving the welfare of the child, not a custody dispute between parties. And I think that the only result you can really reach is that Hochstock and Perales do not control this issue.
Thank you,
Thank you for your indulgence, and I appreciate your
time. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.